The Sky News Centre at 5. At least three police forces are now looking into allegations of historical sex abuse in football. Tanya Snuggs reports.
He threatened a number of times that if I ever said anything that he would kill my two brothers and my parents.
Paul Stewart's among four ex-footballers speaking out about being abused by a coach as a child. Arsenal manager Arsene Wenger is shocked.
I was surprised and amazed that that happens in our game.
Dr. Rosanna Alim-Khan is the shadow sports minister.
We need to make sure that perpetrators know that we will come down really hard on them should they be found out.
England captain Wayne Rooney is urging victims to call a new dedicated helpline.
Relatives of serial killer Stephen Port's victims cheered in court as he was told he would die in prison. The 41-year-old has been given a whole life sentence at the Old Bailey after being found guilty of murdering four men he met online. Five men arrested in France were apparently planning a terror attack in the country as early as next week. French prosecutors say the men were receiving their orders from an Islamic State militant based in Iraq or Syria. The Irish Prime Minister says there's no way leaving the EU will take only 2 years. Enda Kenny's warning the Brexit process will last at least five. He says because no one has ever left the EU before, unexpected issues might crop up.
I would expect to see the divorce, as it's called, take place, but that there be a transition period and then a new relationship founded between the UK and the European Union.
Jaguar Land Rover's confirmed it's looking at making electric vehicles in the UK in a move that could create thousands of jobs. The carmaker says it wants Britain to be a global centre for battery research and development. And a retail expert claims this could be the last ever Black Friday in the UK. It's thought the cheap deals are going to be increasingly spread over a week or two rather than just the Friday after Thanksgiving. That's the latest. I'm Elizabeth Williams.
It's Friday. It's a little bit past 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news, it's Lib Dem councillor for Hengrove and Whitchurch Park, Tim Kent. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, all along the watchtower of Bristol's city walls, a new series on authoritarian Britain examining the building blocks of the police state, which is being assembled around us. Briefing 2 tonight on 2008, the death of capitalism and the greatest heist in history. Day after day, we're expected to believe there's not enough money for this and not enough money for that, whilst nearly 700... million pounds is found with the blink of an eye to refurbish the offices of Queen Elizabeth, the richest woman in the world. So are we being sold a putt day after day, night after night? Is this just glorified smash and grab by the rich and powerful, a kind of criminal elite? Tonight we take a good look at the money system and how some people get a license to make money up out of nowhere while others starve. What really happened in 2008, how the threat of cutting off our money is used to control us, and how to fix this rotten system. Plus, postponed from last week, a couple of items, the religion of war. We look back to the last Republican president, George W. Bush's Iraq victory speech, how hollow his words seem now. Plus, the brave new technocratic world. Little chips that pay money for you. No, where have we heard that before? Tonight, we listen to author Aldous Huxley. Plus Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Apologies for being a little bit out of breath. My car wouldn't start, so I had to walk all the way here, and a little, well, partly run as well. So tonight, lows of 5 degrees Celsius and mainly dry. This weekend, highs of 8 Celsius, mainly cloudy weekend. Next week, again, around 8 degrees with sunny spells. Next weekend, the 3rd and 4th of December, highs of 8 again. Sunny spells too, hopefully not any rain, though, over the next week or so. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Helping us review this week's news, it's Lib Dem councillor for Hengrove and Whitchurch Park, Tim Kent. Hi, Tim. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Good afternoon.
Getting dark, isn't it, now, in the evenings. But first thing I've got to ask you about, Tim, is about this metro bus, because I know you were very much involved in the city's transport policy, making some big decisions about how our money's spent in past years. What do you make of it all? Because I think there's quite a lot of people there wondering, what is all this pain for if it doesn't look like we're going to get much gain at the end of it?
Well, I mean, what we're seeing is cost of delays. Much of this delays was, I'm afraid, when the mayor came into office. He put the scheme on hold because he wanted to review it. Those changes have created quite a bit of extra cost. A lot of that has, of course, come from delay. If you plan to borrow money one year but you do it another, that comes at a cost of millions of extra. I mean, the reality is Metrobus was never going to transform the city's public infrastructure. I mean, the transport infrastructure in the city is dire. I don't think there's any other way to describe it. There's been a lack of funding over many decades. This was just the first step in what was supposed to be many steps. Following this, of course, was going to be a major investment in rail. We've seen that being delayed. We've also seen massive reductions, including the announcement now that we're not even going to get electrification in the city. So I do think, I mean, to be clear, Metrobus was just one of several steps. And it does, that first small step has been delayed, and now we're seeing what should have been the next steps also be delayed or cut. I think people are rightly fed up. They have every right to say to the council, what on earth are you doing about this? And what I hope now as a council, and certainly with the mayor, we can actually move forward and say to government, enough is enough. This city produces a lot of economic benefit for the country. We now need the public infrastructure to keep it going.
Well, is there any evidence that Marvin's doing that?
Well, to be fair, he's only been in office for sort of six months or so. But I think now he's had the chance to get his feet on the ground. Now is the time to push. We've got, I think, unfortunately, but we've got this new role of Metro Mayor coming in that's going to take over transport infrastructure. What we need is less talk and more action, and we definitely need more government finances. They've announced this new infrastructure fund. Let's see some of it come to Bristol.
But what do you make of this new Metro Mayor? Because this is, seems to me like just more power disappearing out of people's hands to higher and higher levels. A little bit like a kind of, you know, when we join the EU, the power goes to Brussels. More and more decisions are made further and further away. And surely that's a similar thing going on with this Metro Mayor. On top of that, you've got the fact that because you've got the three big local authorities that are going to be part of that area, it won't necessarily reflect the wishes of the people of Bristol.
Well, it might not. There's always a danger when you work together. I've always felt strongly the four, but it is now going to only be the three local authorities for the Bristol area working together is a good thing, especially around transport and economy and planning. The problem what we're seeing now is just a couple of people will hold all of that power, and one in particular, which will be this Metro Mayor. And when you put the power into the hands of just one person, you naturally create distance, and that's when you get unpopular decision-making. And I think also there's going to be a great deal of confusion. I think the public feel that this role is being imposed on them. There's very little public engagement in the whole process. We do fear that turnout is going to be diabolical in May. And so there is a real question here of power really going to an institution that nobody understands and nobody really wants. There is some power coming down from government, but as usual, that all gets highly watered down, and in too much power is going up and not enough coming down.
Martin, you were arguing a couple of weeks ago when we had the Tusk chap on here that is saying, well, actually, maybe it would be better for political parties to focus all their attention on national elections because the local authorities have very little power nowadays.
Well, I think there is an element of that because we're going through, you know, there's a kind of smoke and mirrors effect where we're talking about devolving power to metro mayors, but at the same time, the power of local authorities are gradually being undermined through things, you know, through national policies that are made at national level.
You're saying devolving, but you could also say giving away your power, couldn't you?
Well, yes, I mean, just think about having a mayor in Bristol, which I incidentally oppose, as many people did. We had a big row about whether we were going to have a mayor. Then, about 15% of the electorate decided they did want a mayor, so we ended up having one. But in actual fact, the mayor, whoever it is, whether it's George Ferguson, Marvin Rees or anybody else, has got to make millions of pounds worth of cuts, which is what the central government has already determined. And, of course, local authorities then end up getting the blame for what's going on, whoever runs runs them, but in actual fact the decisions were all made in Westminster in the first place, so it's all you know, it's all basically a trick.
Well, I sympathise and generally agree with that. I do think there's a real challenge for local government. People vote for councillors hoping they're going to make a difference. With a mayoral system, our powers are limited. But increasingly, I think Marvin, as mayor, has discovered his powers are limited, because in the end, you're limited by the budget you've got. There's one reason why some people have gone for the Metro Mayor option, because they see a small budget attached to it. My worry is that budget is very small, the ask on the role will be far higher, and that people will be left very disappointed.
But hang on, this is a city deal, isn't it, which the Lib Dems were pushing for?
No, the original city deal, which we got, was before all of this mayoral stuff. That we're all fine for. And the combined authority we support. Where the issue we have is over this idea of the power being put into the hands of one individual. The voting structure for the new combined authority is unbelievably complex. So complex, I've not yet encountered anybody, including the officers who've written it, who actually understand it.
Is that deliberate?
Well, I think what it is it's one of these things where everyone has tried to make everybody else happy. So you have votes where only the mayor votes, you have votes where the mayor and the leaders vote, you have votes where the leaders vote, and you have votes where certain leaders can veto the views of other leaders. That is the voting system that has been developed for the combined authority.
Well, we're going to have some fun with that. And yeah, as you've said, the Metro Mayor actually makes all the final decisions. So what's the point in the voting situation anyway?
Well, yesterday I discovered that turns out not to be the case. Actually, on a lot of powers, they're jointly held, which actually means the Metro Mayor can make the decision, but only if the local authority involved agrees.
So whose big idea was this Metro Mayor?
Well, it seems to have come out of Tory central office. Greg Clark was a big supporter of them, and George Osborne. We did get very close to it being scrapped, actually, when Theresa May took power. For a few weeks, it looked as if they were going to scrap them, but somebody with the voice in her ear managed to convince her to carry on with them, unfortunately.
Amazing. Also, with the whole business of the Metro bus again, I mean, surely, Tim, I'm going to come back to this, because you were doing transport on the City Council in the run-up to this, so, I mean, surely you've got to bear some of the responsibility for all those delays. And now, looking at the whole situation with this, it looks like there's only going to be three of these things an hour.
Well, I won the funding for it, so I was in power. I was in power running transport when we won the funding. I mean, we were very clear. I upped the frequency on the one which was only going to be once every 20 minutes, saying that that is not a frequency high enough. We shifted it up. Unfortunately, since that decision, that's been reviewed by following transport execs, and they've pushed it down. I agree. I mean, if you're waiting for a bus for 20 minutes, that is not a frequent metro service.
You say following transport execs. The name Mark Bradshaw is ringing in my ears.
Well, you would have to ask Mark why that's been reduced down. It's in particular, it's the link from Hengrove to out to Long Ashton. Is that route in particular, which has got a frequency of actually, I think it's possibly less than once every 20 minutes.
Well, Sir Mark has agreed to grace us with his presence in January, so we'll have to ask him all about the what really happened there. At least we know, thanks to you, Tim, what the right questions are to ask. Anyway, thanks for that. So, look, let's have a look, listen now to, because there's been some big developments. Well, I say big. I mean, certainly some plates seem to be shifting in the historic abuse inquiry this week, child sexual abuse, which it certainly looks like has been going on for decades and been consistently covered up by various public officials, including the police. When we spoke, must be 2 years ago now, to Nick Outerside, former newspaper editor, who was himself abused when he was in the Scouts as a youngster. After the Jimmy Savile affair, he then went to his local police force and gave him a statement about what had happened to him. They then told him, oh well, this guy that was abusing you, yes, we've had reports from other kids that were abused by him, but he's now dead. Well, 2 years later, Nick Outerside found that the police were lying to him. Actually, the guy wasn't dead at all, and he was still alive, and he was about to die, and he did die. But you know, this kind of thing does not put great faith in people, doesn't give people great faith in the police when it looks as if the police have been involved in this cover-up. Anyway, this week we've had calls by various MPs, including Chuka Ramuna and the Rotherham MP, who's the MP for the constituency where the abuse happened up in Rotherham, and where Alexis J was doing her inquiry a couple of years ago, which found something like 1,700 children there had been, over a period of about 14 years, had been abused. And she as well has called for a complete rethink, saying that the inquiry isn't working under Alexis Jay, this new chair, who's a former social worker. But anyway, let's have a listen to what the QC Michael Mansfield has been saying this week on the historic abuse inquiry problems. He even suggests that they may be deliberate.
What has gone seriously wrong here is a dismal failure to consult with the survivors' groups from the beginning about appointments and about the substantive materials that had to be assembled. Secondly, the actual appointments of the chair have been inappropriate, one after another. Just how many mistakes can you make? And of course, some of the groups are saying, have these mistakes been made on purpose?
Well, that's obviously a question that's rising in people's minds, especially for the more prominent paedophiles which are being investigated. One of the things about the Jimmy Savile affair is that lots of people who were historically abused by scoutmasters, whatever, have come forward, and that's created a lot of problems for the police because it is a historic, abuse is widespread. But of course, the real problem is that the high level abuse by people in positions of authority. And Kinkora Boys Home, which I've mentioned frequently on this programme, it looks as if MI5 were using the Kinkora Boys Home as a means of blackmail of various political figures in Northern Ireland.
Well, we've also had Sir Peter Hayman, the deputy head of MI6. He was someone who shown to have been abusing kids, and then obviously he's dead now. But if you've got the deputy head of the Secret Services, Tim, doing abuse, then it makes very difficult for there to be any proper investigation. In fact, sometimes more likely there may be a cover-up. Anyway, what's your thoughts about what's been happening over the last couple of weeks with this? Because we've also seen the Shirley Oaks survivors group. We're hoping to have them on in the next couple of weeks, actually, because they've said, well, we're fed up with this inquiry. It's been going for 2.5 years now. Middle of December, we're going to release the names of 60 alleged paedophiles because we've already done our inquiries and we've got their names.
I think the inquiry really it's got nowhere, and it's not likely to get anywhere anytime soon. And you can understand the frustration of the families, and in particular those people who've suffered abuse. I guess the positive I would say that's come out of this is that the more we talk about this, the more it is going to be revealed. And let us remember, we focus on the abuse by the high profile public figures and the abuse of those children in care, which of course is particularly horrendous. But the vast majority of abuse goes on behind closed doors in normal family homes. And the reality is, as people listen to this, odds are you know somebody who's been abused. You may not realise you know somebody who's been abused. And the only thing I would say of good that could come out of this is now that more people are coming forward to report abuse, and hopefully it will make it more difficult for abusers to get away with what they've got away with, and hopefully reduce down the amount of abuse.
I suppose the take home from a lot of this is that if you do have this sexual abuse going on at very high levels, maybe within the Secret Services, for example, it makes it possible for the lower level abuse to happen. Whereas, it just shows that, I suppose, the veil of national security has been thrown over this and used as an excuse to cover it up in the past. And also, I suppose, possibly threats to police who've tried to investigate it, or just having investigations pulled from them. Someone comes along, taps them on the shoulder and says, right, you're off this inquiry now, you're doing something completely different. Or maybe even you're sacked.
Well, I think I agree. We have seen that the establishment have closed ranks and protected themselves, even used abuse over many, many years. But let us not forget, also, I think within society itself, people have suppressed, have tried to stop people from coming forward, have said that best not talk about it, let's move on. What we're now seeing now is a culture where people are going to feel more confident to come forward and report this, and hopefully that will reduce down the amount of future abuse.
Very interesting, very brave, I think, actually, of the Shirley Oaks people to say, well, we're going to release these names. We're fed up with this. It's going 2.5 years now. I think that's what they want, is they just want, at the very least, the names to be known. Then there can possibly be prosecutions, but all the time the names are kept secret of the people that they've collected evidence on as sexual abusers in a systematic way. I mean, effectively, Martin, what happened was paedophiles totally infiltrated the social services in Lambeth Council, and they were running children's homes.
Yeah, well, what I suspect is that children's homes have been a target, like King Cora was in Northern Ireland, for the use of paedophilia for blackmail purposes. And that's not to say that that's the totality of abuse. As Tim quite rightly points out, it's much more widespread than many people realise. And as he says, it goes on mainly inside family homes. Stepfathers are frequently abusers. Not always, but frequently.
Well, another bit of news this week. Well, actually, it's really last week. It's the passing, finally, by the Lords, by the Snoopers Charter. And I suppose we should all be on our knees, really, saying we wish the Lib Dems were back in government again, because Lib Dems did actually block it in the coalition government from going through, but it's now gone through, Tim.
Yes, and so everyone should be aware the government now has far more rights to seize any of your activities, and in fact they have far more rights than any other government in any other democracy. So and it has been unbelievable how that has gone through with virtually not even a whisper against it. I think there are some questions over what were some previous very strong activists who opposed this, who have not stood up and said wait, hold it. And this is the problem we see, is that government use the fear as a factor to get these things through. And what we mustn't allow is that government takes too much power to itself, or actually puts us in such a state of fear we actually give them too much power. And the lack of checking over this and the lack of resistance has been shameful.
Well, about a year ago, I was just having a look at what Michael Mansfield was saying about the abuse inquiry. I stumbled across this interesting clip on YouTube, and I've got a little edit of it here. And here is Michael Mansfield, QC, this human rights lawyer, talking last year about his fears over this Snoopers Charter. And it was once the Conservative government, David Cameron, had been elected in. Some say not elected, because there's 29 constituencies where there's big questions about expenses and possible fraud in the last general election, but they've now voted this through. But this is what Michael Mansfield had to say about the Snoopers Charter around about this time last year.
Well, I think we've reached a historic and extremely dramatic watershed in all our lives. I was brought up in the shadow of 1984, George Orwell. Then everybody said, oh, we'll never have anything like that. Well, we can't have anything like that. You know, our whole lives manipulated, determined, and all the rest of it. That is exactly where we are now. In 2015, we have an Orwellian society in which all our data, our very existence, is monitored through screens and information about every aspect of our lives. And the latest proposals from the government actually put into concrete form what George Orwell was talking about. In other words, every website you visit is going to be stored by the providers, so that somebody else can have a look and say, oh, because they apparently are looking for, what are they looking for? You know, child abusers, terrorists and so on. But they're going to, why don't they shut down the world while they look for criminals? It is outrageous. Legalizing the interception on a bulk scale, storage on a bulk scale, and collection of really social information in terms of the websites. I also happen to know, because it happens all the time, that irrespective of government, and this has been going on anyway with the government since 2000, only they haven't admitted it, is that ordinary commercial companies and operators, 14-year-olds, can hack into, you know, TalkTalk. My bank account could probably drip away tomorrow. So what I'm worried about is the technology is there to take over your life, and it is doing so already. At any level, you can even go and use your Tor router and become anonymous. They can still track you. That's my concern, is that we do not have enough control. We've almost been sleepwalking into a situation, and we automatically, what's the first thing you do when you wake up? Mobile phone, iPad, whatever. What's the first thing you do? You go to a meeting, even the one I've been at. People are on their iPhone and their phone straight away. We've lost the ability to realise that we should not allow these monitors to be inside the hearts of our lives. And I'm hoping people will wake up to the society in which they're now living, and they have to decide, do they want more of the same, or do they want to bring about some ring fencing to these powers so that the humanity that we've all got is allowed to breathe again?
Well, Martin, the Labour MPs in this city actually voted for this, didn't they? It was on national security grounds.
Did they?
Yes, they did.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I was just looking.
That.
I'm just looking. I'll put a link up if you want on the show page at thisweek.org.uk to a map of all the.
I think this national security grounds is absolutely absurd. The police have always had the powers to investigate people.
Shall I say, just say the only big block vote against it was the SNP.
Well, good for the SNP is all I can say. And presumably the Liberal Democrats also voted against. Am I correct?
Yes, we've opposed this all along.
I mean, this national security argument is absolutely specious. The police have always had the powers, if they suspect somebody is engaged in terrorist or other activities, to investigate them and to look at their what they've been doing. General fishing expeditions in general to look at everybody are wrong in principle. They're actually written in the US Constitution, written in the 1770s. They said the interception of private communications by the state is expressly forbidden, not. We might do it sometimes, and Benjamin Franklin said, "Those who are prepared to give up liberty in pursuit of security deserve neither liberty nor security." And of course, the real suspicion is that the people, the intelligence services doing the snooping, are actually involved in the terrorism. But that's another big question.
Interestingly enough, yes, all the Bristol Labour MPs voted for it, except for Thankham Debonair, who abstained. But anyway, it's a bit of a worrying world we're moving into, where we think that it's almost like the kind of presumption of guilt rather than innocence if you're going to just keep all of your internet records. And it means also it's quite easy for the security services, who we don't necessarily trust all that much, to can just go through and do phishing operations
on our lives.
They're
not under democratic control, as the police, in theory, at least, are.
We've had the autumn statement this week. UK government reveals its infrastructure budget. That is a £23 billion fund has been announced by the UK's Chancellor of the Exchequer to provide additional spending in areas he said were key to boosting productivity, transport, housing, digital communications and research and development. Chancellor Philip Hammond announced the fund in his autumn statement this week. It includes £2.3 billion for a new housing infrastructure fund. He said the fund would be used for projects such as roads and water connections that would support the construction of up to 100,000 new homes in the areas where they were needed most. Maybe he's helping out Bristol Water there, the private water companies, with public money. Further, £1.4 billion will be used to provide 40,000 new affordable homes. Tim, sounds like good news.
Well, a lot of this does sound like good news. I've always been a strong believer that during difficult times, what you do is you invest in your infrastructure, and that will help build you out of difficult times. The money for affordable homes is particularly welcome. I think there is sometimes a slight difference in interpretation of what is an affordable home between what a Conservative government minister considers an affordable home and what a normal person might consider an affordable home. The key thing I would like to sort of push here is the real need for us to put money into public infrastructure in some of our cities. If we want our cities to continue to thrive and we want to continue to get the tax returns to keep the country going, we need to deal with congestion, and only through some very serious money can we do that. And 50 million here or 50 million there might sound a lot, but in public transport terms is very small fry. And if we want to really tackle congestion in this city, we need billions to be coming here.
I wonder, we're talking last couple of weeks ago again, Martin, weren't we, about the idea of free public transport, how much it would cost to make the buses free in Bristol, because that would take a hell of a lot of weight off the roads, wouldn't it? A lot of people would just hop on the bus instead.
Well, it would cost you about £30 million a year.
Well, that's less than 50 million, so maybe that's doable. Martin was just suggesting that the other day and explaining how in Ken Livingstone's London in the 1980s, he had a whole plan to slowly move towards free public transport. Of course, the other great benefit of that is you get much less injuries on the road, whether it's cyclists or pedestrians.
I mean, something to be said for it. I mean, the issue is sometimes when you make something completely free, it sometimes loses its value. But I think trying to make sure public transport is affordable...
So do you think people would just get on the bus and go round and round just for the sake of it?
Well, actually, some people do. That's not necessarily a bad thing if there was no one else in that seat.
Well, if the point about if you make things free, there's a cost involved in people paying. Mm. You know, ticket machines, ticket collectors, etc. So one of the things about making things free is you can write all that off. And of course, it's thinking big and thinking outside the box. Now, we don't do an awful lot of that, but I mean, in Seattle, I understand, in the United States of America, public transport is free. That's the home of Silicon Valley and all the rest of it. That's the future.
The other thing is, of course, in the cold winter months, if you're homeless, actually getting on a bus and going round and round might actually keep you warm and keep you safe, other than being out freezing on the streets. Another similar story here, the billions of wasted NHS cash no one wants to mention. This is on the Our NHS website. Come on, one of the national newspapers, pick up on this wonderful journalist called Caroline Malloy. She says, as calls mount for the NHS cash crisis to be solved by charging patients, there's one pot of money that sits glistening and untouched. Calls to solve the NHS cash crisis by charging patients have mounted, with the NHS Confederation calling for £75 a night hotel fees for hospital stays, or much longer waiting lists. But there is one pot of money that sits curiously unexamined, glistening and untouched. It's the cost of the NHS market itself, administering the hugely expensive artificial marketplace created by successive governments to allow NHS and private providers to compete with each other to offer services to purchasers and the NHS. No one knows the exact cost of this bureaucratic marketplace, but a recent estimate by Rebel Lib Dems put the figure as high as £30 billion a year. So, I mean, we could solve the NHS, it looks like, deficit overnight just by getting rid of this marketplace. And well done, Tim. Well done, Lib Dems, for doing this little calculation, which no one else thought to do.
I'm not sure how you become a rebel, Lib Dem. I didn't think we actually had enough left to have a rebel. But this article is
from 2014. It's not absolutely bang up to date.
Yes, well, that's how you have a rebel, Lib Dem, then. I think there's a very good question over the marketplace. I think I understand where those from the right we're trying to do with big bureaucracies, you can get waste. The problem is when you try to bring in a marketplace, you create a whole new level of waste. Actually, this goes back to the same discussion about making bus travel free. Yeah. And that is where you actually try to put in costings to stuff that's free, you actually sometimes generate additional waste. And I think that's what this is pointing to, is that everyone is billing each other. And having recently tried to navigate the NHS to get an appointment with a consultant, it took several different meetings and several different appointments to get the one we needed, because no one wanted to pay the bill because it all went to certain cost centres, and it was such a bureaucratic nightmare. So I've actually experienced this myself recently. I have no doubt it's costing billions of pounds. Quite rightly, the NHS has got a challenge in front of itself. It needs to reduce costs so it can reinvest that money into frontline services. This could be the first place to look at.
I mean, one of the maddest things in the world, Martin, is this whole idea of doctors being put in charge of these clinical commissioning groups, having to be basically hawking around the marketplaces, trying to get the cheapest deal here and there.
Well, that's what doctors used to do before the NHS existed. They were essentially businessmen who sold medical care. And of course, the concept of the NHS, and it was at the time of the 1940s when people believed in planning and the superiority of planning over markets. And what we've seen is the Tory government brought in the purchaser-provider split. We had 13 years of Labour government where they didn't undo the reform. Then we had a coalition government where we carried on with the same. And I would argue that the fundamental principle of the NHS, which is what makes it the most efficient in the world, despite this internal market, is that it is in fact a top-down planned exercise. And in actual fact, if we went back to the original conception, provision for free. For example, you've seen various hospitals complaining about the foreigners have got to show their passports before they get treated and so on, saying we've got enough to do without looking at people's passports. That's actually an extra burden on us. It's not saving us any money. And if things are just free, and don't forget that some diseases, and this is the whole point about diseases, they're communicable. If you don't get the person with HIV at an early stage, they pass it on to somebody else. So it's actually much cheaper. And things like needles, for example, you want redundancy in this. In other words, you always use clean needles, even if it looks like a waste on the balance sheet, because that means nobody gets infected with HIV, and that saves you a lot of money in the long run.
I can remember a similar thing at the BBC, actually, in the early 1990s. They brought in this thing called producer choice, where you used to be able to just phone up and get bits and pieces of information from all over the corporation, and all of a sudden, good old John Burt, bless him, brought in this system where you've got to fill out a little form, and you've got to get the permission of your producer and your senior editor if you want to make a phone call. That seems to me to be what this excellent article is all about, and I'll put a link to that up on our show page if people want to go and actually have a look and see how bonkers this market in the NHS is and how much it's costing us. Anyway, the UK has been seen to be borrowing £122 billion more than expected, says the Office for Budget Responsibility this week. Britain's government will end up borrowing £122 billion more over the next 5 years than it expected before the country voted for Brexit, Chancellor Philip Hammond said on Wednesday. Britain's expected to run a budget deficit of nearly £22 billion in 2019-20 financial year. I suppose George Osborne is sort of hiding under a rock somewhere. He doesn't really want to talk anymore because it doesn't look like he's getting anywhere near meeting his fiscal targets, Martin.
No, and I think this is what's happened is that the government have basically given up attempting to reduce the deficit on the timescale they originally suggested 8 years ago or even 5 years ago. And nobody's even picked up. That means, in actual fact, that a lot of the pain that people have been put through was unnecessary and pointless. But of course, they're not. I mean, what, you know, I suppose there is one more rejoicing in heaven over one sinner that repenteth than the people that, you know, in a way, the fact that they've accepted that they can't get it down on that timescale is a positive thing. And what's particularly...
Well, hasn't the actual reality come to bite them in the bum, really?
Well, that's exactly. Reality was always going to come back to this, that you can't actually get it down in that kind of timescale. But what I find particularly risible is all of these Tories attacking the Office for Budget Responsibility, which they set up to be an independent voice telling them what the actual figures were, instead of the chance and the Bank of England cooking it up in private, and then when it tells them what they don't want to hear, they want it abolished. And in any case, it's not even clear that it could be a lot worse than that. If Deutsche Bank collapses and there's a big crash like 2008, it's going to be a lot more than 122 billion. That's just presuming that everything just carries on as it is now, which of course is a big presumption.
Tim, also we've got Tory MPs just voted down a bid to reveal the impact of their £3.4 billion welfare cuts. Even Ian Duncan Smith has called on the government to reverse the planned welfare cuts. This is in the Mirror. Tory MPs voted down this week a motion calling for them to come clean on how hard their public spending cuts have hit on Britain's poorest. The government used to prepare a distributional analysis of spending cuts ahead of the budget, an autumn statement which breaks down how hard people are hit by their income by income bracket, but they stopped publishing this last year. Labour tabled a motion calling on the government to scrap the cuts and start publishing the distribution figures again, but it was defeated by 24 votes. Labour's John McDonnell said further cuts to benefits would be a harmful disaster for low earners and the vulnerable if the government fails to do a U-turn in next week's autumn statement. Well, of course they didn't. The Shadow Chancellor said the planned cuts to employment support allowance build and universal credit would hit the quality of life for millions of people, Tim.
Well, the government are doing all they can to hide the fact that universal credit is going to really hit some of our poorest families. And it particularly will hit, which is a slight irony about it, those families which are trying to get into work or on the breadline, and they're the ones that are going to suffer the most. Also, those with disabilities, so if they get ESA, will find them, they're getting hit as well. I think they need to take a hard look at this. I understand things have got tougher with the Brexit decision. That doesn't mean you pass on the punishment to those with the least in society.
But
I do hope they have a rethink about some of these cuts, which are being hidden around the universal welfare rollout.
Well, that just seems very unlikely that they're going to have a rethink, because all of the motion seems to be towards taking, really cutting the welfare bill right back, what used to be called Social Security. Do you remember that? You pay in, and then when you need it, you get the money back. Well, apparently they don't really want to give you the money back. You get sanctioned, you just don't have any money, you can't pay your rent, etc., etc. And it seems to me that we're moving towards a world where there are no benefits, Tim. That's the way we're heading.
No, I agree. And one of the issues around benefits, which I think people need to understand, is what people have seen is a large rise in their rent, especially from the private rental sector. That's not their fault, and they're not getting the money. In fact, often it is private landlords who make donations to the Conservative Party who are getting the money. And I think we need to completely relook at our housing structure. And before we cut people's benefits, we need to be able to provide them with affordable housing. Not say to them, no, you've now got to pay this extra £100 in rent each month, which you can't afford. Giving people that choice is no choice at all. So I think one of the challenges is to deal with the costs of housing and not actually try to attack the poorest that are forced to live in this expensive housing.
Well, before we hear from Martin, let's go to the House of Commons on Wednesday from Prime Minister's questions with the subject of disabled benefit cuts. cuts came up. I think it was Angus Robertson brought it up.
Angus Robertson!
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. We in these benches have repeatedly brought up the devastating impact on disabled people from the UK benefits system. The government plans to cut support for people with long-term health difficulties by £30 a week. Last week, my SNP colleague, the member for Airdrie and Shotts, proposed a motion which was passed by this House with support from both Labour and Conservative members for these cuts to be postponed. Yeah. Will the Prime Minister act on the vote of this House?
Yeah. Let me say to the Right Honourable Gentleman what we've been doing in relation to benefits for disabled people. The overall funding for disability benefits will be higher in every year up to 2020 than it was in 2010. We have been focusing support on those who most need it, those who are not able to get into the workplace. For those who are able at some stage to get into the workplace, we've been providing a wider package of support, and I'm pleased to say that over the last 3 years, nearly 600,000 more disabled people are now in the workplace with the dignity of having a job, which is what many people with disabilities want to have. So we're focusing help on those who most need it and helping those with disabilities who want to get into the workplace to do just that.
Well, I think this is the fact is that many disabled people in poor communities do not vote Tory, and the desire to punish these people is actually quite popular amongst swing voters in marginal constituencies, and that underlies all of this. And I think we've mentioned the film I, Daniel Blake, which I went to see the other week. And I think there's actually an element within the Tory party that actually likes the idea of punishing people when they're poor. And they know that that actually gets some votes in certain communities that they're keen to...
I mean, is that about deflecting the blame because the rich are not paying enough tax?
Well, I mean, when you think about the wealth of our society in general, the fact is that many employers do not want disabled people in the workforce because they'd rather not have them. And so the idea that the disabled should be made to work for their own benefit, even if it costs us more to make them work. I mean, don't forget the assessment procedures. We were talking about this earlier. The assessment procedures to decide whether people are available for work are actually highly expensive. And I would argue that in principle, and you see that in the film, I, Daniel Blake, the doctors have decided he's not fit for work, but the private sector providers of the reassessment by decide that he is fit for work. I don't think the case cannot be made, to my mind, that anybody other than a qualified doctor should decide whether somebody's fit for work.
Tim,
nobody else should make that
decision.
Why
are we trying to force or persuade disabled people to go to work when we've got an increase in 12% of people aged 16 to 24 who haven't got a job? This is the so-called NEETs, not in education, employment or training. The number of those without a job is now 857,000. So that's over three quarters of a million of the youngest people can't get a job, and yet we're saying, oh, the disabled people are going to have to compete for it at all. The whole thing just seems like some kind of ridiculous marketplace where everybody is beating each other up to get the price down for a job. And of course, if the price is down for a job, then you can't pay the bills.
Well, I think a lot of disabled people do want to get a job if they can. The problem is that there's so much pressure on them to get a job, which often might not be appropriate given their disability. I think the problem is they're being demonised by the government. And we should remember, disabled people have a lot of backgrounds. What we often be told is people trying it on and trying to claim off the system. I'll give an example of another disabled person, actually one of my co-counsellors who was on disability benefits. She was on disability benefits because she was a serving soldier who was injured while serving this country, preparing for deployment to Afghanistan. So I think a lot of people need to remember those people also claiming benefits are there for some extraordinary reasons. Some of them actually were fighting for this country, and that's why they're disabled. So I think we need to fight back and say that the demonisation of disabled people is unacceptable. And that is why the government is able to get away with trying to push these cuts through, because they have convinced the public that basically people are trying it on. Actually, people are fighting with pain and agony every day.
I also think it's fair to say we shouldn't be demonising anybody who's unemployed. You're trying to compete with nearly three quarters of a million people who are just out of university and just out of school. How on earth are you expected to get a job? I mean, it isn't easy. It certainly isn't easy. And of course, all of this really, Martin, is about creating this vast pool of unemployed people so big employers can cut their wage bills.
Well, I remember, I'm old enough to remember when the first, when unemployment went over a million in Britain in the 1970s, and people were shocked and horrified, and a million unemployed, this is going to lead to riots in the streets. Even Tory MPs were shocked. But now we've got used to having at least a million unemployed.
Not riots on the streets, it's more people sleeping on the streets.
Well, yes. I mean, we've not had full employment in this country for a generation. And if there's not full employment, then you can't argue that everybody should get a job, because they can't, especially not if they are disabled. And, of course, the employers don't necessarily... In Cuba, the disabled are all employed. But, of course, they don't have a capitalist system. Every employer has to have their quota of disabled people on their roll. But it's not a capitalist way of running it.
Maybe it's easier to get a job in Cuba. The other thing, of course, is when all of these basic things like housing, water, gas, electricity, all those things, food, are cheap, then society runs a whole lot easier, folks. Anyway, let's go back to the House of Commons again, where Jeremy Corbyn, leader of the opposition Labour Party, had some questions about, social care? That's right. Very important topic, and something which local authorities were and are responsible for, but massive cuts to the budgets by central government.
Mr. Speaker, Sir Simon Stevens told us 2 weeks ago that the next 3 years are going to be the toughest ever for NHS funding, and that 2018 would see health spending per person cut for the first time ever in this country. And the NAO reported that the cost of health tourism is over 100 times less than the 22 billions of cuts the NHS is facing from this government. The reality is, Mr. Speaker, under this government, there are 6,000 fewer mental health nurses. There are a record 3.9 million people on NHS waiting lists. All of us who visit A&E departments know the stress the staff are under and that the waiting time is getting longer and longer. And that there are 1 million people in this country not receiving the social care that they need. So instead of looking for excuses and scapegoats, shouldn't the Prime Minister to be ensuring that health and social care is properly resourced and properly funded to take away the stress and fear that people face in old age over social care, and the stress that is placed on our very hard-working NHS and social care staff?
Billions of pounds extra into social care through the Social Care Precept and the Better Care Fund. £500 trillion being spent on the National Health Service. A record level of investment in mental health in the National Health Service. But there's a fundamental point that the Right Honourable Gentleman refrains from mentioning. It is this. We can only afford to pay for the National Health Service and for social care if we have a strong economy creating wealth. Precisely what he's going to hear from the Chancellor of the Exchequer in a few minutes' time.
Well, I think that's just wrong. A strong economy, if we're thinking about the demand in the economy, the people at the bottom, the people on who need social care, the people who are disabled, the people who are unemployed, the people in expensive private sector accommodation, if those people have more money in their pockets, that will boost the economy far better than ill-conceived massive infrastructure projects. For example, building Hinkley C, which costs a lot, but what is the effect on the economy? The figures don't add up.
And it costs us much more in electricity too, doesn't it?
Well, indeed. So, in other words, getting the social welfare of the population right is not an optional add-on when you've got the economy right and then you've got some resources to spare for looking after people. Looking after people is fundamental, and it's fundamental to making the economy function as well. I mean, later on, we won't probably have time to discuss the potential for things like basic income, universal income. So like universal credit, except instead of means testing it, you just make sure that people are looked after. And then you could have free public transport, free healthcare, free education, and most people wouldn't have to, you know, most of their lives without spending a lot of money at all.
We can, and we do have time for it. Scotland could trial giving each citizen a universal basic income. This is in The Independent this week, development of a radical scheme, they call it radical, it's just common sense actually, which could see welfare benefits including child and tax credits replaced with universal flat rate payments due to be tested in Fife. Scotland could roll out the universal basic income pilot after a trial won huge backing from anti-poverty campaigners. Development of the scheme due to be tested in Fife will be discussed this week by councillors, civil servants and members of the Scottish Basic Income Network, and would see welfare benefits including child and tax credits replaced with a universal flat rate payment, Tim.
What worries me about the concept of the flat rate payment is it sounds very attractive and you think, OK, you can get rid of the bureaucracy and it gives everybody a guaranteed level of income. My concern is that, one, you might be giving money to people who don't need it, but secondly, my real concern is that those people who do need money and currently get higher rates would suddenly see drastic cuts. And that's where I am a little bit sceptical. I do want to just briefly mention on the NHS, I do think, you know, what was being said there is very important. I think we need to stop the debate, though, that we can just give the NHS free money. If we want the NHS to have more money, let's accept that involves a tax rise. And let's be honest, let's be upfront. That's what now the Liberal Democrats are saying. Put a penny on everybody's tax. All that money goes directly to the NHS and social care, and they can see where it goes. We think people would accept that because the NHS and our health and the health of our nation is so important, people would be willing to accept that increase. But I think, you know, we need to win that argument now across the political spectrum.
Now, we did mention it briefly just now, but also homelessness came up at Prime Minister's Questions on Wednesday too.
Kirsty Blackmore!
Mr. Speaker, Aberdeen Sirenians have launched a financial appeal because of the increasing numbers of people finding themselves homeless as a direct result of the UK government's pursuit of austerity.
Yeah.
Mr. Speaker, how can the Prime Minister sleep in her warm bed at night knowing her government's policies have consigned people to a cold Christmas?
The government is taking action in a variety of ways to address the issue of homelessness. Of course, one of the key things we need to do is ensure that we do see more homes being built in this country. But I just say this to the Honourable Lady. She talks about austerity in the sort of tone that she refers to it. Actually, austerity is about us living within our means. We should always remember when we're talking about government providing support for individuals that taxpayers have to pay for that support, and many taxpayers are themselves struggling to get by.
Well, they certainly are, and they should be not be paying for the Queen, who should be living within her means, rather than taking £700 million of taxpayers' money for a refurbishment of Buckingham Palace. It was one of those things which really irks me to see. We're taking money away from people who have virtually nothing and giving it £700 million to the richest woman in the world. We had Kevin Cahill explaining how rich she is last week here on this programme. But all is not lost, because there is always the possibility of squatting, which is taking over an empty building because investors have bought them or whatever, and they're speculating on them. And actually there are quite a lot of squatting going on in Britain. And just to announce, there is a new squatter's handbook out. This is telling you your legal rights as a squatter to take over an empty building. You can't squat residential properties nowadays, and that's available for the princely sum of £2 from the Advisory Service for Squatters in London, and also from AK Press in Edinburgh. But back to the main point there, I suppose, Tim, homelessness, at the end of the day, is the big motivator, isn't it? When someone comes along and tells you, sorry, you're going to be evicted from your home, it's time you're going to have to act, aren't you?
Well, we get it a lot as councillors. We're approached by people quite often facing homelessness, and it is a really difficult situation. The council has very limited properties to offer people, and sometimes the advice of the council is fairly extreme, pointing out that people have to literally wait till the bailiffs come round. Otherwise, the council won't accept that you're homeless. We're seeing now a definite increase in street homelessness. We're seeing that amongst young people. We also, of course, see it amongst former servicemen as well. And I think what we need to accept is lots of people can quite easily get into a position of homelessness. Sometimes people are literally just one paycheck away from being homeless. What we now need to have is a far more fluid approach. We need to have flexible housing which can get people into. I think too much government's got into trying to specify how pristine a house has got to be. What people need is sheltered accommodation, especially during the winter months. Certainly at the council, I think that is being talked about more now. So rather than the idea of trying to find three-bedroom houses. Having temporary accommodation we can get people into is a necessity. It's a great cost to the council, so we also need help from the government to be able to do this. If we can get people into accommodation, we can then help them deal with the situation that got them on the street, and hopefully we can bring them back into society where they'll actually then be paying taxes and working, and in the end we all benefit.
But Martin, this is a great motivator, isn't it? If someone comes along and says, listen, you're going to lose your home, you're going to do something, you're going to do something fast, aren't you?
Well, one of the things about Universal Credit, which Tim was mentioning earlier, is because of his desire to sort of improve the poor, IDS insisted that the Universal Credit and housing benefit payments would no longer be paid directly to landlords. They would be paid to individuals who would then pay their landlords so that they would learn how to manage their money. But the response of the private sector to that, including Tory supporting private landlords, was in that case, we're going to kick out all of those on benefits from our properties, and we want people who are in work in those properties. And I was caught in this trap myself a couple of years ago because I was on benefits at the time, and I found it virtually impossible to rent a private sector place. Now, in other words, that's just an administrative decision which has made it so people can't get social housing because they haven't got the priority. They can't get on the housing ladder. They can't even get into the private rented sector because the private landlords, unless they're paid directly, aren't prepared to put those people up. And that means they end up on the street, which means that, and as I understand, and Tim will correct me if I'm wrong, there's more money being spent by the Bristol Council on putting people in bed and breakfast as a result of them ending up on the streets through this kind of process, so which is more expensive than housing them properly.
Well, this change is just coming in, but thankfully we've managed to get an exception for public sector housing, so social housing, but only, of course, when someone's got a couple of months into arrears. So already social housing landlords are projecting this will cost them millions of pounds a year. And what they're saying is they know which of their tenants will not have the structure in place to be able to meet these costs, but they have to wait until they get into trouble before they can act.
So why are they doing it, Tim?
Well, this is very much a philosophy approach, I think, of the Conservative government. I think where they're wrong is they think everybody should take control of their lives. Yeah, well, some people need help.
Some people can't. Simple as that, isn't it? Time for the Murdoch News at 6 now. Thanks to our guest, Lib Dem Councillor for Hengrove and Whitchurch Park, Tim Kent. After the news, all along the watchtower of Bristol's city walls, our new series this week on 2008.
An award-winning community radio station for Bristol. Bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.